Welcome to Hair Metal Memories. We are your hosts. I am Brian.
And I'm Aaron.
We're at hairmetalmemoriesiowa@gmail.com if you care to write to us. And people have been writing to us, and we appreciate that.
We love it. Thank you so much for sending us messages, however you send them. We love it.
Yeah. I was looking, and our last episode was published September 20th. And
we're sorry, people.
And we
are sorry.
December 11th today, which feels like a long time ago.
Life happened. Things happened.
Yeah.
One of the bands we played in had to get ready to play our last show ever.
Yeah.
Another band that we both play in had to finish up our season of shows. Yep. And then there was some health stuff in my family. So we have had other things we've had to do. So we very much apologize for the delay. And thank you all for sticking with us.
Yeah. Yeah. We definitely appreciate it. We're trying to get back on track and stuff, but it is, you know, this is a labor of love. And so that's what you get.
We ask no money for it. We have no sponsors. Yeah. We're completely free. Yeah. So
we appreciate you putting up with our idiosyncrasies and life changes and stuff.
Thank you.
Yeah. In the meantime, I've seen Queen and Peter Gabriel. I saw Pat Metheny and Steve Hackett. None of which are hair metal related.
I saw The Room in the theater with Grant Sestero in the crowd. It was pretty awesome. I haven't been to a show since then, I'll be honest, that I haven't played at.
More hair metal related, we were guests on a podcast on Adam Blackburn's Metal Education, which is a
Please go listen to it. He was a great host.
He was a great host. Yeah, it's on Valley Free Radio out of Massachusetts. We posted a link to it on our Facebook page, but you can probably Google that too if you're interested at all. He was great. It was like cool to be on the other end of things.
And
you know?
He sent us a freaking record.
Yeah, he did. He sent us a record, which we're probably going to do like an episode on.
So we're pretty much going to have to talk about it because that was like one of the nicest things that's so great. I mean, no reason. He didn't have to send us a record, but he's just like, nah, man, this is for y'all.
You should check his show out, though. It's really good. And we are super close to 40,000 listens.
Just ridiculous. It boggles the mind.
Yeah, with quite a few of our episodes over 1,500 listens now. So thank you. It's utterly bizarre and wonderful.
If you're going back and just discovering us now and you listen to the Dawkins episode, we're sorry.
Right.
We actually have talked about maybe doing a remastered episode on the Dawkins record because you can tell we had no idea what we were doing.
Right.
We may or may not have roped somebody into our guest spot that we put on the spot very unnecessarily.
Yeah. There's been lots of cool concert announcements going on. I've currently got tickets for Mr. Big, Iron Maiden, and Extreme next year.
Holy shit.
And I'm looking at tickets for Judas Priest, who just announced that they're going to tour. So
and I believe we've secured tickets for Queensryche and Armored Saint.
That's right, exactly.
That's exciting, because Queensryche is going to be featuring the first EP and the Warning album, which, I mean, they're incredible, and Todd Latore can actually hit all those notes. Yeah. Subtitle to the story is Give Up Smoking, Jeff Tate.
and we've got some fun stuff coming up in our next episodes. We have been thinking about this a lot. We'll just tease you for now. A lot of stuff has kind of happened. We landed some really cool things that you
wouldn't in a million years think that, like, you know, just the right sort of connection of just knowing this one person who knows this one person who just sends a message off to this one person who gets back and says, no, that sounds great.
But today we're going to do a deep dive on another
much
requested album.
Everybody's talked about this. Originally I kind of thought that maybe I didn't want to talk about it. And then I was like, no, that's stupid. You like this album. You want to talk about this. And we actually announced it on that guy's radio show.
That's right. Yeah, we did. Yeah. It's the debut self-titled album by Bullet Boys. And this may be skipping a little ahead a bit on the memories part, but we just went and saw these guys recently opening for Tesla.
And they were so good.
They were phenomenally good. I was blown away by them.
Fun fact is Mick Sweeta apparently hates Mark Torian's guitar playing. I saw a little article about it. He said, it sounds like you're just throwing silverware down the stairs. I'm like, no, I disagree. I actually think Mark Torian's a fine guitar player. We saw him, you know.
He's shredded.
Dude ripped it up. I don't get what the problem is, man. We know what the problem is. And it's because most of the people in Bullet Boys don't like Mark Torian anymore.
Right.
It's not our argument, so we don't have to take a side in it.
Right.
I kind of looked into it because, you know, they reunited in like late 2019, right before the pandemic hit. They announced that the original Bullet Boys lineup was reuniting. They were going to tour and they were going to play all these shows. And it fell apart pretty
really quickly
fast after they got back together. and not Lonnie Vincent, but the drummer, Jimmy DeAnda, was like, well, it all kind of comes down to one guy. We're not going to get into it. We all know who it is.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's a bummer. Because I found an article from Mark Torian that he's like, I don't get why all these people are saying all this stuff. I'm not going to speak any ill of them in the press. I'm not going to do that. So, yeah. You know, once again, we're not there, so we don't know what goes on behind all this stuff. But
no. It
also sounds like the other three guys who weren't Mark had a band that they had started together with Andrew Freeman, who I think is the singer for that Dio tribute band that has all the last in the has all the original lineup, that Last in Line band.
Oh, yeah,
I think he sings with them. He may have sang with Great White for a hot minute. But it sounds like that band that they all had together kind of ended in not the best of terms. So it sounds like everybody involved might have some bone to pick with somebody else in the band,
yeah.
You know, besides Mark. So it really just sounds like a whole lot of mess.
Yeah. Yeah. Everybody's got stuff they can't seemingly let go of.
Yeah. So. I did this whole long dive into, you know, what sort of happened to like the Bullet Boys after the last.
Yeah.
In the last handful of years, and it seems like every time they all get back together, it sort of implodes.
It sounds like they're really done this time, though. I mean,
it does.
Yeah, Mark's touring with his
so
new band.
So it goes.
But, yeah.
You know, on the other hand, you know, Mark's new band has Ira Black as the guitar player, who's the guitar player for Lizzie Borden. So whatever, dude, that guy was awesome. We saw him. He rocked, and Lizzie Borden kicks ass. So, I mean, if he's good enough to be in Lizzie Borden's band, he's good enough to be in Bullet Boys.
Yeah.
Screw that.
I'm glad they're still doing it. Yeah.
That's right, because we thought they were awesome.
Bullet Boys have sold over 1 million albums, with this one selling 500,000 alone. Which is pretty good for a band you don't hear people talk about that much.
And, you know, Mick Sweeta confirmed, he's like, we went gold on this record and we were still in debt. Like,
yeah.
Because if
crazy.
He said we wanted to make a video, they were just like, sure, make a video, spend whatever you want. He goes, what they don't tell you is a lot of the money that labels give you, it's a loan.
It is a loan, yeah. They call it recouing, I believe, is what they call that. We recouped all your money. They started in L.A. in 1986, which is right in the thick of things, I think, in terms of the hair metal timeline.
It had already blown up, and I think, because half of the band came from another band that kind of had a big go at it.
Yeah.
And even with Carmine Appice, they couldn't
That's right,
it.
Yeah. So we got Mark Torian, he's the singer, and he's the only member who's remained the same during the entire history of the
he
band.
He was also a guitar player in Rat at one point.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, and Bullet Boys has had a lot of members, but we've already talked a little bit about that.
But the core who were involved in this album.
Yeah, they had been in a band called Hawk. It was the name of the band they were in, and as well as a Motown recording artist band called Cagney and the Dirty Rats.
Yep,
which is a great title.
That is a great name.
Great name for a band. Yeah. And Mark Torian was also the lead vocalist of King Cobra.
With Mick Sweeta and the aforementioned Carmine Appice.
And that's the one with the Carmine Appice, yeah. And it was after Carmine had finished playing with Ozzy. And Johnny Rodd from Wasp was also in that band and on bass.
I recognized that name and I didn't click on it.
King Cobra released three albums and they toured with Iron Maiden, Kiss, and Nugent. Then Carmine Appice. I love saying that name, sorry.
He decided that he wanted to go do Blue Murder.
Yeah, he dissolved the band to go to Blue Murder, which is
because
a callback to our Blue Murder
episode. Because it's like, you mean I get to go play with John Sykes and Tony Franklin?
Yeah,
sure, all right.
Yeah, why would I not do that? See you later, guys.
Music history is riddled with people going, you mean I get to, if I leave this band, I get to go join a band with this guy and this guy? Okay, see you later.
Right, that is how a lot of it does
and
work.
You know how often it works out? Not as often as you want it to.
Yeah, grass is always greener.
Did you ever hear that Beck, Bogart, and Appice album?
Yeah.
Not that great.
No.
You know what is great? The album that they made when Jeff Beck was originally hurt and couldn't make an album with them, they formed a band called Cactus who whipped out like three fucking fantastic albums in a row
and
then broke up.
Great.
And then you get Beck, Bogart, and Appice and you're like, this is what we waited for? Like, seriously?
Yeah. You're like, it's one of those things where the supergroup does
it's
not
okay,
live up to it.
It's okay, but
whatever. Mark Torian also had a band called Touch in 1984 that had a song included in Rocky IV. But just the movie, not on the soundtrack. The song didn't make it the soundtrack. It was just in the movie.
Was there actually a soundtrack released for Rocky IV?
I think there was.
Because, you know, along the same lines we were talking about when we talked about White Lion, they actually did a song for the Money Pit soundtrack, but that soundtrack was never released. So that song just had vanished to history because, like, MGM or whoever owns the rights to that song.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
so on and so
forth. Yeah, there was a Rocky IV soundtrack, but they didn't put it on for some reason.
All right.
Yeah.
It wasn't just, like, Bill Conti music?
Right. Yep, that one out, yes. He has a side project called Sexual Chocolate, which I love. That's the best. I don't know. I love that name.
Because you might remember him as Joe the Policeman from the What's Going Down episode of That's My Mama.
And he auditioned for Ozzy on guitar after Randy Rhoads died, according to the Rudy Sarzo memoir.
And, you know, Rudy has been around.
And he auditioned for Motley Crue when Vince Neil left. So Mark Torian has like a solid.
I'm so glad that you mentioned that because
he would have been great.
I was a big Motley Crue fan when the whole thing went down with Vince Neil leaving, and they did this article. I think it was in Metal Edge where they were like, "Here's all the people that we think would be good replacements for Vince Neil," and one of the people they mentioned was Mark Torian.
He would have done a great job.
Would be a great one. Yeah. And then they said something like, and the funny thing was that they said, "We think John Corabi would be a good pick too, but we don't think they'd ever pick him." And they also said something like, that they thought Doro Pesch would be an awesome vocalist for Motley Crue, which is really weird, but I would listen to that because Doro Pesch kicks ass. She has one of Lemmy's ash bullets. Remember that, everybody. Go look it up. Lemmy got cremated, had his ashes put in a bullet. Doro Pesch got one. Anyway, moving on.
The guitarist and co-founder of Bullet Boys is Mike Sweda, as you mentioned, who was also in King Cobra. And he had more of a punk rock background. He was the guitarist for two records and two tours before he left King Cobra. He's had a long solo career. And he briefly collaborated with Troy Patrick Farrell, who was the drummer for White Lion briefly. So a little bit of connecting there.
Wow, where does that drummer fall in the White Lion timeline?
Later, definitely.
Okay,
later.
So like Mike Tramp sort of leading the pack era. Okay,
Mike Tramp era.
Okay.
Yep. Bassist Lonnie Vincent. He's harder to find info on.
Holy shit, you too, huh?
Yeah.
Man, I tried to dig on that guy, and there's just not much that comes up. The best thing I could find was some YouTube. There's a website called Full and Bloom that does articles, does interviews with various people. And Jimmy DeAnda had some interview where he talked about being in jail with Lonnie Vincent.
Oh, wow.
And Lonnie and him being like, boy, Lonnie sure seems to be like not that phase that he's in jail.
Yeah. He was in that band Hawk with Mark Torian. And he was in King Cobra too, so I think he might have followed Mark Torian. Basically,
it sure seems like it because he's also the one guy out of the original lineup who still talks to Mark Torian.
Okay, that all tracks then.
So they're old buddies. It kind of lines up there.
Yeah, and then drummer Jimmy DeAnda recorded three albums with Bullet Boys, and he's also worked a lot with George Lynch.
He was in Lynch Mob.
Yep, he was in Lynch Mob. And mental note: we should do another Dokken record sometime.
I would be happy to. I want to do the one that has Dream Warriors on it, just because I like Freddy Krueger related things, and so naturally, I'm drawn to their album. That's way in. That's a 60 freaking minute album crammed on one LP.
Yeah,
you fucking 80s people with your 60-minute albums. You ruined it for everybody. I just want you to know that.
I just got the Black Friday deal, that Dokken box set with the first four albums
on
it.
I saw you got that, and I would love the Dokken box set. Yeah, I actually thought about getting the vinyl box set, but the thing is, the only album I'm missing is Breaking the Chains.
Yeah.
And then it's even weird with Breaking the Chains because the original German release and the American release are not the same. One has a song called Paris is Burning that's live, and one has one called Paris that isn't live, or I might be mixing those around, but all the same, they're not the same. So I'm like, well, I should get the original German one because that's where it first came out. Because, you know, he was in Germany doing the demo vocals for Scorpions.
Right, yeah.
You know,
so many rabbit holes,
Exactly.
And Jimmy DeAnda also worked with Janie Lane from Warrant, which I thought was kind of another cool connection. Just briefly on one thing.
Yeah. I saw his name come up.
Yeah, and he works on TV music now, and he has his own studio. So he
seems like a solid career, doing TV music.
Right.
I could chill out at home. You send me some reels. I look at it and go, okay. You know, you play your little music. You collect a check.
Yeah.
Solid work.
Yeah, it sounds like a dream job, honestly.
Absolutely.
That's what I would like to do, yeah. Bullet Boys got compared to Van Halen and AC/DC a lot, which in my view is pretty high praise.
It is high praise, but the thing is, it's kind of weird because, you know, I remember hearing the Van Halen things, and outside of the Ted Templeman production,
same.
I don't necessarily hear it. I don't think they sound that much like Van Halen.
I don't think so either.
Yeah. And I mean, you know,
other than the production quality,
I don't
right.
mean to be, you know, comparing to Van Halen's a good thing or whatever, but I just don't think they sound that much like Van Halen.
Yeah. They signed with Warner Brothers, and they released this album in 1986, and it peaked at 34 on the Billboard charts, which is not shabby.
No,
man.
Not bad at all.
They released two singles from it, For the Love of Money, which is a cover of an OJ's tune.
And apparently that's Mark Torian's favorite song ever. That's what he said when we saw him live right before they played that song. He's like, this is my favorite song of all time. I just want you to know that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's great. And it's such an odd choice, but it's like.
But, you know, the funny thing is when you listen to their whole album, it actually makes you realize that it's not that weird of a choice because they're a lot groovier than like a lot of other like bands that we've talked about.
Yeah, they are. Yeah.
You know, the funny thing is Warner Brothers, when Warner's was signing them, they actually wanted to put them onto Reprise Records that they were trying, because they were, you know, Reprise had sort of fallen into disuse in the 80s, and Mick Sweeta was really excited about that because he's like, well, I'm a huge Neil Young fan and I love Reprise Records, so yeah, I think that'd be great, but it didn't end up happening that way, but all the same, so, you know, they ended up on the big label.
But For the Love of Money got up to number 30 on the Main Street Rock chart and 78 on the Billboard Hot 100. And then the other single was Smooth Up In Ya, which did a little better at 23 and 71, respectively. Both of those tunes got heavy MTV airplay.
Well, see, and you know, this is actually a really good album or at least the singles from the album are a good way of highlighting how much more pull by 1988 MTV had than, say, like a rock chart.
Yeah.
Because
it really did. Yeah.
I know all sorts of people who remember that Bullet Boys song, but, you know, gauging by their chart success, there are just as many songs that maybe got that high on the charts that just have completely vanished from sort of the cultural memory. But like more people remember that Bullet Boys song.
Right. So yeah.
It had a video that got played all the freaking time.
It was a cool video.
It was.
After this album, their second album didn't do nearly as well.
It has a Tom Waits cover on it.
It does, which is very cool of them.
And actually, that album is pretty freaking good. Like,
But then they did another one, and ditto. It didn't do as good.
Would have been their last for Warner Brothers, if I'm not mistaken.
And that was the last one. And that's when Mike Sweeta and Jimmy DeAnda quit the band. That was 1993. So
Lonnie held on for a little bit longer.
Yeah, hair metal was waning, as we've seen over and over again. You know, Mark Torian and Lonnie Vincent reformed again in 1998 with Steven Adler of GNR on drums and future GNR guitarist DJ Ashba as well. So that would have been a
future
good band.
Motley Crue guitarist DJ Ashba. Well, officially a guitar player, but he hung out. He did some guitar tracks. He wrote a bunch of songs. Remember that song, Staying in Los Angeles? No, you don't remember it because it was a shitty song. I saw them play it live. It sucked. but he did help write it for better or worse.
Yeah. And they've had numerous lineup changes and some ups and downs, but in 2019, we talked a little bit about this before, the original lineup got back together, and then they left due to toxicity is what they described it as.
I just think it's funny, because both, even, you know, in the interview I read with Mick Sweeta, he's like, look, dude, I'm not just going to bag on Mark, but a lot of the problems were there, but at the same time, because there was like one of the songs they were talking about on the album. He's like, actually, that was like Mark wrote that riff. And like, I just kind of finished out the arrangement and stuff like that. So, they, you know, of course, you know, you figure a lot of people, they were like 20 something when they started this band. So, of course, they're little shitheads, you know? I mean, we were all little shitheads when we were in our 20s. Like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. And in one of the interviews I read with Mark Torian, he said he didn't drink or use drugs. And so, like, I was thinking, because I thought, well, is he just like a drug addled rock star kind of thing and difficult to get along with? But he claims it. I don't have no idea if it's true.
I mean, maybe do you think drugs would have helped?
Maybe not enough drugs. If rock and roll has taught us anything,
you know, maybe you should have had a fucking joint once in a while, man.
Yeah, right.
Because you know they have a song on that second album called THC Groove. And unless everybody out there, does THC mean anything else besides what I think it means?
This is completely a tangent, but I just bought the new Steven Wilson album that's called The Harmony Codex, and it's being abbreviated THC.
So. Okay, so they were like, they went into the future and decided they like Steven Wilson, went back in time, and okay, never mind, I take it back.
Prog-nerd moment, sorry. I did find an interview with Jimmy DeAnda where he talks about hearing rumors that during the reunion stuff, which was during COVID, that the band were talking to other drummers to replace him because he didn't want to play during COVID.
Yeah, I heard about that too. That like, and, he was like, no, I'm not going to go do that.
And he sounded pretty angry about it. And he said the guys used to, when he first started the band, the guys used to haze him. So it seemed like he was maybe like triggered by some of their behavior. And stuff.
I do know, you know,
just a bad foundation when they got together.
But he was even cool about the fact that like, you know, he's like, well, look, I'm going to leave, but I'll help you find a drummer to keep so that you guys can keep doing your thing. It doesn't have to just be like me leaving, ending it all.
Yeah, yeah.
So he was trying to be cool.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's not like there's just some bad feelings that probably could be communicated, but, you know, probably won't be.
But you also have to, you know, you think about the fact that these guys have been in bands together or a band together for a long time back when, and like a lot of festering things sort of don't just easily go away, so.
Right, that's what it seems like, yeah.
I mean, not everybody can be like Halloween and just have everybody regroup and be happy, you know.
Right,
I mean,
yeah. We talked a little bit about Ted Templeton being their producer. I love it that their producer was the Doobie Brothers producer. That's like,
and remember this, the guy who was their producer is the guy who was the lead vocalist on Life, I Love You, All Is Groovy, ba-da-da-da-da-da-da, feeling groovy. That's Ted Templeton.
Yeah. 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 He's got like the most insane list of credits too. Cause I mean, he's at Captain Beefheart.
He does have Captain Beefheart.
He did a John Cale album. Yeah, so
holy shit, I didn't know about the John Cale album.
Yeah, yeah, he's got. I went and kind of looked through his stuff, and I didn't know how deep it went. Actually,
because admittedly, I looked at it. I associate with Van Halen and stopped there, and I got way more into digging into like the assistant engineers and shit like that.
Yeah, which is kind of enough if you think about it. His place in history was secure, but he's done so much other stuff that and off-ball stuff that you wouldn't have guessed.
Well, because the thing that struck me was the engineer on this album. I don't know if that's where you're going now, but
no, perfect.
The engineer is this guy named Toby Wright, who, as a child who listened to a lot of '90s music, that name resonates deeply because I remember seeing Toby Wright's name on Alice in Chains Unplugged, on the self-titled Alice in Chains album. He did Fear Factory, Fishbone, Jerry Cantrell, Kiss, the Carnival of Souls Lost Sessions. He engineered that. Or I'm sorry, he produced that.
And Ozzy and Slayer.
He produced a Korn record, but that's garbage, and Korn. We won't hold that against him. And Third Eye Blind. Also bad, but better than Korn because pretty much everything is.
And Trey Anastasio.
And Trey Anastasio. almost everything in the universe is better than that. Almost everything at Godsmack is better than Trey Anastasio. And Godsmack is trash. Okay.
Yeah. And the cover photo is pretty cool. It's
It is cool. It's a really popular. I think that photo was originally taken in the 1930s.
Yeah, it's called 30.30 Bullet Piercing an Apple by Harold Eugene Edgerton, who is largely credited with transforming the stroboscope from an obscure laboratory instrument into a common device. And he was also deeply involved with the development of sonar and deep sea photography, and his equipment was used in collaboration with Jacques Cousteau in searches for shipwrecks and even the Loch Ness Monster.
The more you know.
Right. Yeah, thank you, Wikipedia. I thought that was fascinating enough. I wanted to pull that out though because like that is
some hip shit.
Yeah,
that I would like to add too.
That guy's a super genius, and I didn't even know who he was.
Right, and now he made the Bullet Boys even more well known.
Yeah. Right.
Which right up there with the stroboscope.
That's right.
And I would also like to highlight this album was mastered by somebody named George Marino. Mm-hmm. In the world of the vinyl nerd, of which I unfortunately am, that name doesn't get brought up as much as it probably should. Because for the longest time, George Marino had the only mastering studio in the world that could master for both like for surround mixes and vinyl and digital. You know, there's probably been some labs since then, but his studio is a kind of a big deal. And George Marino, he cut his teeth originally cutting the Hey Jude 7-inch single. So he managed to fit an almost 7-minute song on one side of a single, which in the world of the mastering engineer, Well done.
Yeah, and that's a hell of a start.
And he also mastered John Lennon's live piece in Toronto, 1969. So the guy's got some. He also did American Pie, Billion Dollar Babies.
Wow, that's some big shit.
Stevie Wonder's Talking Book. Yeah. So this guy's got a great mastering history. Everybody's good as somebody like Bob Ludwig or Bernie Grundman or something like that. So if you go look through his mastering history, you should check out those records because they sound fucking fantastic.
Yeah, that's an impressive list for sure. Damn. Does this album pass the hair metal smell test?
Oh, God, yes, does it ever.
I think it does too, but...
Oh! Everybody I know has a big butt. Let's talk about your big butt.
So I read an interview with Mark Torian, and he said, and I'm just going to read you what he says about it.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, because I feel this is relevant to the larger conversation of hair metal that we're having.
It is.
I guess we were known as a hair metal or hair rock band, but I don't think we ever were. We were always just trying to write great music. But there's also some other aspects of our music that ended up on all of our records that were different. We stood apart from other bands. We weren't Poison or Warren. We were this street band called the Bullet Boys. That's what we were. We weren't about a lot of makeup, hairspray, or anything like that. We were just trying to play great rock and roll music for the masses, man.
You know, and he's not wrong there. And also, pursuant to his point, and I think I said earlier, this album is a lot groovier than a lot of the other albums we've talked about.
It's got swing to it. Yeah.
There's a little bit, they all have their personalities or whatever. And actually what I think it leads more to is a sort of thing like, okay, a lot of people like to say that grunge all kind of has like a common sound, or people like to say that like the early days of thrash have a common sound, or that hip hop has a common sound. But like any one of those genres, when you start digging in and learning the language of whatever genre, you're like, no, they don't all sound the same. They do have their own unique sort of phrases and dialects and whatnot. It's just that if you don't like the genre, you're not going to dig farther to figure out what's going on. Motley Crue and Rat, maybe they kind of skated along sort of the same lines there. But, a lot of these bands have a lot more individualized language than people like to think they do.
Absolutely, yeah. And that is exactly why we're here.
Correct.
I think so too. But Mark Torian says he doesn't like the term hair metal. And so I thought I would read that because
Sebastian Bach, and they are, that's a completely fair thing to say because it is kind of overgeneralizing.
And it is a bit derogatory.
We just understood that it was a way to get you to listen to our show.
And we love the music. And so you can call it what you want, but we know that this is the common term that has,
Tesla said, you can call it what you want.
What are your memories of this one?
Well, it's funny because I didn't have the album when I was younger, but one of my friend's older brothers did, and he would just play it, and I just remember thinking it was just really good. Mm-hmm. I listened to Smooth Up back in the day all the time because it was on MTV all the time, and I was one of those kids who I got home from school and I would just watch MTV until I was told I couldn't anymore. I heard Smooth Up and their For the Love of Money over and over, just thought they were fantastic. And then when I was 19 or 20, I was at a record shop and they had a copy of their album in the $1 to $3 bin. And I saw it and was like, screw that, man. $3, I'll buy this. It still had the printed inner sleeve and everything. So took it home, cleaned it up. Sounds great. And I came to appreciate the entire rest of the album. So when I heard it when I was younger, I wasn't really familiar with anything that wasn't the big songs, but I always liked it. And so what about you? I mean,
I kind of missed out on this one, honestly. I heard Smooth Up in You quite a bit, but this one, for some reason, I didn't make it to it. I don't know why.
Perhaps
it must have been some sort of timing. '88,
maybe had you gotten big into a blues kick or anything, or was there
not yet. Okay, yeah, it's kind of it is kind of weird. The timing of it is such that I'm surprised that I missed it because going through it with doing research on it, I fucking loved it. I thought it was great. I was too bad I didn't.
And the other thing
earlier
is 1988. There's a lot of albums out there. You can't get around to everything. You just can't.
Yeah, I was a lot more broke back then, too. So it was like,
you were like a college student, right?
Right, yeah.
I was also broke, but instead of being a college student, my argument was I was fucking 8 years old, dude.
Yeah, that's a pretty good argument, yeah.
Fucking 8 year olds, dude.
Yeah. Yeah. I would have been, 86? That's. 88. Yeah, I would have been first year in college. So I would have been checking out a lot of hair metal at the time. But I think that was one of them where I just, like, you know, was sort of like, I can't afford this one and just never looked back on it, sort of. Which is not a great reason, but, like, you know,
I'm glad I'm here now.
And then I'm glad my only real memory is going to see them open for Tesla. So it's a good one, you know.
No, yeah. And that was a great memory, too, because, you know, I didn't know what I was getting with the Bullet Boys because I didn't have any sort of reference point for their live show, and I was just thoroughly blown away by it, you know. Yeah. You don't think about just, like, these bands from the 80s that are still touring today, just how, like, on point they are to this day. And, of course, they had to be on point or they wouldn't still be touring, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they do. Production was part of the 80s. And so they're still like roaming the stage and doing the rock star moves and stuff like that, which is very entertaining.
It is. And don't get me wrong. I'm okay with a show where everybody just stands still on stage and doesn't vote and just plays their music, because I'm fine with that. I don't care.
Yeah. But there is something about that rock thrill of seeing people run around.
It's really enjoyable watching them just leap about and all that stuff. And, you know.
Yeah. So overall, the album, my overall notes is that I thought it sounded really good, just because of all of the production that went into it. And it's a lot of fun.
It is a good it is a good example of how, like, if you don't listen to, like, the 80s kind of glam rock stuff, you could just overlook this as just another one of those records. But it does have, like, an individual personality.
It does. And the other big note I had overall was sort of like, the lyrics are pretty uniformly, it was a different time territory.
People liked to have sex in the 80s.
Right, yeah, yeah.
And they weren't afraid to tell you.
Mm-hmm. Nope. Yes, so with that in mind, let's start out with the first song, which is called Hard as a Rock.
Well, actually... I dug into this, and I'm pretty sure that this song is about chert. And chert is a hard, fine-grained sedimentary rock composed of microcrystalline or cryptocrystalline quartz, the mineral form of silicon dioxide. Or it could also be about an erection, but maybe...
You choose your battles, yeah. You got your interpretation.
Maybe there was a science nerd in the band.
Yeah, yeah. Could have been.
I said it could be an illusion, too.
Yeah, it starts out with a cool little bass slidey thing that you don't normally hear in this kind of music.
The bass have the opening notes.
Yeah,
like,
that was pretty cool. My other note was this song is about boners.
And not Boner from Growing Pains, the character, but actual, you know.
Yeah, has a really cool bridge section.
It's a really good opening track.
It is a good opening track.
One of the cool things about, like, when you thought about the era of the LP or the cassette tape is you were like, well, sequencing matters, so we need to make sure that it... does all these things.
Yeah, the bridge that does that cool classic hair metal move thing of different chord progressions with possibly a modulation in there. I couldn't really tell for sure. I didn't spend, you know, a lot of time analyzing it, but it sounds like it could have. And I was just sort of like, I was like, man, that's a, you know, that is something that we've seen in the bridges of hair metal songs a lot. So
they, yeah, a lot
I like
of,
it. It's a good move.
A lot of guys from the 80s were really fond of the bridge.
Yeah, yeah. And then we dive into the hit. Or one of the hits, Smooth Up In Ya. This is the longest song.
It is also a considerate song advocating for the use of Astroglide. Show some consideration, guys. Lube it up.
Yeah, yeah. That's a really good perspective. I like that.
That's how I choose to frame it. Yeah. But once again, this song has a killer fucking groove to it.
It does.
And it's really weird because it almost seems like the bass is like higher in the mix than the guitar.
It does.
And the other thing that's weird to me is you'll notice that Mark Torian is not in any way credited with any guitar on this record. It is all Mick Sweda.
Yeah.
So, and I was listening trying to be like, did they just decide to not credit him for guitar? But no, that's literally just Mick Sweda playing. Like,
yeah, yeah.
Now I'm pretty sure the solo is double tracked. Is Mick Sweda double tracking off himself? Because there's some harmony going on.
Some harmony going on. Yeah, yeah, yeah. This was their first single, their biggest success. This was used in a couple movies. It was used in Empire Records and Hot Tub Time Machine.
Oh my God, it was in Empire Records, wasn't it?
Yeah, and it was used in the show Euphoria on HBO Max
Max.
Yeah, yeah. Which I was sort of impressed.
One, Also has one of those little like pre-solo bridges.
Yeah.
And the cool thing I noticed about it is, you know how like a lot of the times, like in a Poison song, you get done with the chorus and then you do this bridge that has like one little verse before CC comes in?
Yeah.
Well, there's not really a verse there. Like Mark Torian just does some vocal ad-libbing and then we go to a solo. So like they wrote this whole bridge and he doesn't really write a verse to go in the bridge. That's cool.
That is cool. Yeah. And I thought with all the harmonized guitar stuff going on and stuff in the solo, let's just play that.
Yeah, let's do it.
That is nice. Yeah. Yeah. And super catchy, man. I get it, you know. Then we go to Ode to Joe. This is the shortest song. They follow the longest song with the shortest song.
And it has a cowbell intro, so bonus points right off the bat.
Yeah. And I am pretty sure that this is about Aerosmith.
You know, it's funny because I actually looked it up and they said, well, I mean, it's not expressly about Joe Perry, but it's kind of about Joe Perry because he was thinking about, like, you know, Guns N' Roses and all these other bands who all are clearly big Aerosmith fans. Yeah. I was wondering if it was about Joey Bishop, you know, from the Rat Pack. Not at all. Not even kind of. I did make that note. Is it Joey Bishop? No. You know why? Because he wasn't funny.
No.
So we can rule him out. It also wasn't about Joe Meek because regardless of how good of a producer he was.
Right. Yeah.
Probably not Joe Meek either.
Yeah. Yeah, but I think you're right about Joe Perry, though, because he has, like, the lines in there about train kept rolling, back in the saddle, and all the names that are dropped in it, too.
And it is just a badass little rock and roll tune.
It is. It's a cool tribute, too.
It is stripped down to the essence of a rock and roll song, which is probably why it's called Ode to Joe and why it's only 2 minutes and 40 seconds long, because they were like, we're just going to make this song that's just all about the essence of what fucking badass rock means, you know?
Yeah, and Aerosmith have, like, some pretty strong hair metal influence, I would say.
Oh,
and
very much so.
And they don't get enough credit for that from the those bands. So it's like
the funny
nice
thing
to see
is
some of this.
Even the thrash metal bands love them. Testament covered Aerosmith. I mean, Testament freaking covered Aerosmith.
REM covered Aerosmith.
Yes, they did. They did Toys in the Attic.
Yeah. Then we've got Shoot the Preacher Down. I love the swagger and attitude.
The song
of
rocks
this
like
song.
Fuck. That was my first note. Was this song rocks like fuck? And my next note was that Lonnie Vincent was on fire on this song.
Yeah,
the bass really gets like the look at fucking me right now. He was good on this tune.
Yeah. Yeah, it has a cool jazzy breakdown bit in the middle with some like you know some jazzy chords and some bluesy playing. This is where I do get the Van Halen comparison because this reminds me of Ice Cream Man.
Because Van Halen was also fond of sort of doing that. Yeah. Let's take like a 50s like shuffle beat and
you can definitely see.
Yeah.
Shoot the Preacher Down is their Ice Cream Man basically of the album. But
So I get where you're coming from there. That's fair.
Yeah. Then we've got For the Love of Money, which is the OJ's cover that we talked about before.
And when when we saw them and when they got ready to play this, Mark Torian comes to Mike and goes, I just want you to know this is my favorite song of all time.
Yeah. It's the second single. And this song has been covered by Queensryche, Todd Rundgren's Utopia, Katie Sagal.
Well, because Katie Sagal is an awesome vocalist.
Nectar.
Wait, what?
Nectar is one of my prog nerd bands.
Oh my god, I love Nectar.
And a bunch of other people. Yeah, this song is. I didn't realize how many covers. There's a long list of people who have covered this song.
I didn't fully realize that either. And I love the OJs. Like I love the OJs. Time to Get Down is one of my favorite songs ever. So I guess Mark Torrey and I have that in common. And one of our favorite songs is an OJ song. So.
Yeah. And I didn't know until I was doing I've listened to that song a bunch of course and stuff, but like I never really like listened to the lyrics. That closely before, I had no idea how fucking cynical the lyrics to this song actually are.
Oh man, there's actually like a lot of you listen to that or like Backstabbers, there's a lot of OJ songs to get like really on the cynical tip, man.
Yeah, I didn't realize that. So, and then the next song is called Kissin' Kitty. And I wrote, guess what this song's about?
I did too. And you know what? I personally have two cats in my house. I get it. Yeah. They're wonderful and I love them.
Yeah.
It could also be about something that has nothing to do with actual felines, but I don't know.
I kiss my cats all the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
I love them.
Yeah.
This has a great vocal performance on it, I thought.
I also noted that you can tell that this is like when they were sequencing the album, they're like, this is a good way to lead off side two.
Yeah.
It comes out swinging. And apparently this song started as a King Cobra demo.
Oh, really?
It was originally a King Cobra demo. And I guess when they got to Bullet Boys, Mick said they wanted to like sexy it up. And so that's why we get the one we get.
Yeah, it has a really nice throb to it, which does sort of like up the sexy factor to it.
It could have originally been called Having a Kiss with a Kitten.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I wasn't there.
Yeah, they knew they were sexy bitches.
Well, you know, man, Mark back in that day, man, with that blonde hair and dancing around, that was a sexy kitten.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Then we've got Hell on My Heels. You gotta love a song that starts with 1, 2, fuck you.
And you know, the thing is, the reason why I remember that so well is they played that song when we saw him.
Yeah.
Cause I remember hearing him do the 1, 2, fuck you and going, oh yeah, right on. Yeah. And it's just like a properly sleazy, groovy, trashy 80s rock song. I don't know what more you would want from it. I mean,
yeah, the first line of the song is, well, it's bourbon for breakfast. That's how you start a fucking rock song.
Jeez, guys, that's so irresponsible. Clear liquors for breakfast. Yeah. You do the darker liquors afternoon.
Right, yeah. Yeah. So this
for
is
for gosh sakes, yeah, you this, sloppy.
This is a song about being a badass, is basically, you know, what's going on. And so they're and it has strong AC/DC vibes.
Did you know
on
they
it.
Like to drink in the '80s?
Right. It was a different time.
What? Of all the nerve.
It has another great vocal performance, I thought. This is another high point.
Really does open it up on this tune. And it starts kind of this run where I'm kind of, a lot of bands do this thing sometimes where, like, the side two stuff is where you kind of bury the stuff that you're least proud of.
Right.
Boy, it really seems like, though, that with side two, they like backloaded a lot of this album.
They did. I would agree.
Did you get the
definitely agree.
So many albums don't feel backloaded the way this one does. And that's kind of a gutsy move for your first record to not be like all the coolest shit we're gonna have.
Yeah, you gotta put that in the first four songs or whatever.
All right, guys. That's cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And during the middle section, he kind of trades off with the guitar solo, which I thought was pretty cool. And I thought I thought we should play this too.
I think we should.
And you know what? And by the end of this song, I'm pretty well convinced he is a badass. He's done a good job of
that. Put the clams in my linguine, the mix in my martini.
Then we've got Crank Me Up. And this tune has a great start. It builds up really nice. It rocks with a fast tempo on
and
the drums.
This one was my best example they're really saving like the gems for the back half of this record. Was the one that really made me go, wow, dude, why is this not on side A?
And the harmony vocals on
it are
really good.
And, you know, so much, like we pointed out, a lot of this album, it sounds like Lonnie, the bass player, is mixed higher than Mick.
Yeah.
But on this song, Mick is like, he's like, no, this is my tune. Listen to this. And Mick owns it.
He does own it. And it's a little, it did remind me a little bit of I'm the One from Van Halen, you know.
Oh my gosh, I didn't even think of it. Yeah.
It was a little bit.
Okay, yep.
Yeah. But not, you know, I don't know.
Not like
not too much.
You can tell.
It's in the ballpark kind of a thing.
You can tell that they had records that we have, you know, that we.
Right. Yeah. And there's a pretty sweet solo on this one, too. I thought.
Oh, here we go again. All right. Let's. Suck it!
and it modulates for the outro section. So that's some nice song construction there.
Modulation. How many times have we got to use the word modulation?
I'd love getting to use that.
Maybe like the Winger album where we got to talk about modulation?
That was a lot. Right, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Wait. No, we got to talk about modulation on the Mr. Big record one time.
Yeah. Yeah. I have to imagine there's a musician or two in our audience, so I figure that's you know, throwing bones out to the musicians in the crowd.
We're obviously talking about D&D modules.
Right. Right. And they also dropped their own band name in this tune, too, so that's cool. I like
that. Hey, you know. Yeah. Just in case you... Yeah. In case you were wondering, this is the Bullet Boys.
And speaking of band names, the next song is called Badlands, and this song is about the band Badlands.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. I actually, on an outtake version, they do mention the name Ray Gillen.
No, not really, but I can't resist dropping them whenever I possibly can.
And see, once again, this is another one of like one of the best songs on the whole fucking record, and it's saved to the next to last song on the whole album. Yeah. I mean... That's the benefit of making a 34-minute album is you don't have any place to hide anything.
Yeah.
You know, on a 40-minute album, 42-minute, 44-minute, you got a little bit of fudge room sometimes. If you're going to turn in 34, it's got to be tight, and they are proving this.
Yeah. And I also thought that this probably has the most poetic lyrics on the entire album, actually.
Well, I mean, I guess that depends on, you know, what crosses that poetic threshold for you.
Yeah, exactly. But like in the context, it's like sort of like it has the best lyrics on the album, and it's the second to the last.
Yes, it probably does.
Yeah. And this is another song about being a badass, really. But this time it's from the Badlands instead.
It is from the Badlands. They were on high wire, you might say.
Toss up.
Mark Torian was telling us about his dreams in the dark.
Right. Nice.
Thank you.
And then our last song is called...
A chord.
F-sharp 9, it's called. And I'm baffled by this because unless that's the name of one of the chords used in the song, but I don't think it is because...
I was listening to that for the whole time. I'm too like, these all sound like...
They're perfectly normal chords. They're not like, you know.
So I don't understand the inspiration. If anybody out there, like seriously, when we post this and we put it up on like Facebook and everything, if anybody knows anything about this title, please let us know. Because like.
I don't get the title. Yeah.
I like it. I think it's great to just call your song F-sharp 9. But give me some insight here.
Yeah.
Because the lyrics offer no insight.
No.
And that's cool too. Like that's okay. Right. You don't have to like explain your title in a song by any means.
Right.
You don't even have to have your title related to the song. I'm fine with that. Black Dog, anyone?
Yeah.
But I'm baffled. It is a great closer. It serves the proper function of being an LP closer, and it's wonderful.
Yeah, it's a great song.
What the hell?
Yeah, the chorus reminds me of GNR a little bit.
Mark, since you're listening, and I know you're listening, please message us.
Yeah, and there's some great moves in the song where the band climbs and then switch to the next part, and you can tell they worked it all out. And then they give it like they put it at the end of the album and give it a throwaway title. It is very weird.
And for a sober band, like come on, guys,
right?
That makes it even more baffling. Okay, like if y'all were like doing some coke, I'd be like, no, I get it, man. I've been there. Not that I would advocate for that.
Are you ready to talk about some records?
Oh, we probably should. So, this one, like a lot of other records, when it came out, it got the LP treatment all over the world. US, Germany, Japan, continental Europe, China, Canada, everywhere else. And the thing is, the trail goes super cold after 1980. Literally, between 1988 and 2009, there are zero issues of this album.
Okay.
In 2009, Warner Brothers actually did a CD reissue, and I'm sure it's fine. It has never been repressed to wax in any capacity.
Oh, really?
So if you don't have a 1988 pressing of this, you don't have this. That's just all there is to it.
Oh, so that one that you have in your hands right there?
Yes, the one that is sitting right next to me. This is the original. This is the original promotional pressing. As you can see, there's the little gold stamp down here about how it's the property of Warner Brothers Records.
I didn't realize how rare this was.
I didn't think it was either, because like I said, when I bought it was $3 freaking. But like, this LP has lapsed entirely from print. It is now fetching not $3 prices. It has been reissued on CD for all of you who are much more sensible people than me. So, you know, don't take that as your baseline. In Europe, it was reissued on Music on CD, which is the digital subsidiary of Music on Vinyl. So there is a 2020 CD reissue that seemed to have lined up with their reunion as a band, which was very considerate. Rock Candy also did a reissue in 2014, who also did the Badlands albums. There's some fun facts about the Badlands. If you listen to the interview that we did with on the radio show, he actually lends some really interesting insight into the Badlands Rock Candy reissues if you're wondering why you can't get those now. But yeah, so this album is a pain in the butt to score on wax anymore. But for anybody who is a digital or CD fan, you will not be left in the dark in any way it is available. But yeah, the wax just goes blank after 1988. So the vinyl history lesson today is good luck.
Wow.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, that is the way it goes sometimes, I guess.
You know, like Friday Music or Real Gone or Run Out Groove, somebody will pick one of these up and reissue it. Or like I just bought a reissue of Slaughter's second album. And shit, that was expensive.
Yeah.
Because it was on some tiny, tiny, tiny little label that did like a vanity press of just a handful of copies. Yeah. So
I have to imagine it's worth somebody's time to repress this, though.
Don't tell my lady, but that was a $50 fucking reissue. So, you know, some of these little boutique-y labels, it's great that they want to keep things in print, but sometimes you have to pay for the boutique-y labels at boutique-y prices. So maybe it's for the better. Maybe you'll wander into your local shop and find a Bullet Boys record for not a lot of money, and for God's sakes, grab it. And I'm guessing a segment of our show that will yield equally fruitful results is Gear Talk. That response tells me everything.
Yeah, there's not a lot. I'm gonna play
the song
it's not really Gear Talk, so I feel bad. I'm gonna caveat it, but here we are.
Asterisk.
Yeah, the caveated Gear Talk. I couldn't find any gear stuff online for them, but I did find a story about Mark Torian selling his pants online for $7,000. So that is my Gear Talk for this time.
We would also like to announce a GoFundMe. Right. We're trying to get $7,000 for unrelated expenses.
Right.
That may or may not have to do with pants.
Yeah, and if anyone wants my pants, let me know.
I'm selling a pair of these are Levi's. They're not $7,000, but if you would like to send that much for an unrelated cause,
right?
We are listening to offers.
Yeah, but do they have that Mark Torian smell?
I have been wearing them for like 2 weeks, so maybe.
Yeah. Anyway, on that note, thank you guys again for listening, and we will get at you much sooner next time.
Thank you. The turnaround time will be better.